Curious Talk on KTNF AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Good morning to all of you joining us locally by radio and streaming online. We appreciate you tuning in. Today is Sunday, April 29th, 2018, and I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz. I'm joined in studio with Maddie Love and Scott Lohman, and on Skype, our special guest, Callie Wright from the Gaytheist Manifesto. Today, we're going to talk about Star Trek. Star Trek premiered in September of 1966 with a three-year run for its first portion. This futuristic universe was set in space, exploring the universe. It's also tackled a lot of issues considered too controversial for normal TV. And it had a suspicious lack of religion. So today we're going to talk about Star Trek and its effects on our lives and the culture itself. This is an open conversation, and we welcome and encourage listener interaction with your phone calls to 952-946-6205, your emails to radio@mnatheist.org, or tweet us at atheisttalk. The phone number is only available when we are live, but you can always email or tweet whether we're live or you're listening to the podcast. Maddie, Scott, Callie, welcome to Atheist Talk.
Hello, hello.
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 Hello. So, Star Trek, The Next Generation. Well, okay, actually just Star Trek.
Yep, we have to go back to that.
We have to go back to all of them.
Yep.
All right, so first let's just go through the iterations. So you have Star Trek, the original series.
Yep.
You have The Next Generation.
Actually, you missed Star Trek, the animated series.
I did miss Star Trek, the animated series.
Yep, and then we got to come.
We're already screwing things up.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's why I'm here. then the first couple of the original series movies.
Yes.
Next Generation came out in 1987.
I was four.
Yep. And then Deep Space Nine came out in 93.
Yep. Then
Voyager in 95. And then Enterprise in 2000. And now Star Trek Discovery in 2017. Those are the series. And then there's the J.J. Abrams movies, which are the Kelvin universe. And those came out in first one in 2009. On that, and then we're 2 years after that. And at this point, there's talk of two different new Star Trek movies, one with the Abrams cast and another one currently in talks. So, yeah, Star Trek is alive and well at the ripe old age of 52, or coming up in 52. It'll be 52 in September, if you go by air date.
I was going to say, that actually brings up an interesting question then, because would then they... No, I don't think it's on longer than Doctor Who. Okay.
Nope, Doctor Who has it by
3 years, I think.
Nope, 63 is when Doctor Who premiered.
Yeah, and this one came out in 66.
The
3 years different.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see here. Let's start with which of these is you guys' favorite series? Callie, do you want to start?
I'm going to get murdered.
Ooh.
You're going to say Enterprise, aren't you?
No, I was going to say,
I think I have an idea
which one is your favorite.
Who the hell do you think I am? Oh, my gosh,
nobody
no.
says Enterprise.
No, DS9 is my favorite.
That's what I thought you were going to say. You're not going to get murdered.
And, okay. Well, so it's not as unpopular an opinion as I thought. Mm-mm. To have DS9 as a favorite. I was kind of surprised because, I mean, like, the default is everybody's like, oh, original series or next gen, or like, who's the best captain, Kirk or Picard? And like, my favorite way of answering that question, like, okay, Kirk, Picard, Sisko, actually, yeah. Sisko yeah. is yeah. the answer to that question. By far, DS9 is my favorite. Next gen is like the closest to my heart because it's the one that I got into Star Trek on and kind of grew up with.
Yeah.
And I grew up without a dad, so Captain Picard was very much a father figure for me. But if I'm looking at what stories I think are the best social commentary, the best of what Star Trek is to me, then I think DS9 is hands down the best of them.
Awesome.
Definitely on that. I don't let anybody nail me down. Period. I like all Star Trek, and I will defend section of Enterprise as well as even Star Trek Nemesis. So that is how hardcore I am. I mean, I can easily just throw something in. The nice thing about Netflix is if I don't have enough time to watch a full hour or something, they have the animated series on Netflix, so I can go in and watch the anime. 22 minutes, it's wonderful. It was the only Star Trek that won the Peabody Award, which for really good television on that is the animated series. And the episode was written by a Native American and talks about gods.
Hmm. Interesting. We'll come back. We'll put a pin on that.
Yeah.
Maddie,
yeah.
Do you
I like, not love Enterprise, and I actually enjoy all of the next gen movies. Like, it's cool to say, yeah, like, oh, First Contact was good, Generations was okay, but Nemesis and Insurrection were terrible. And no, like, I think Nemesis and Insurrection were great Star Trek episodes, mm-hmm, maybe not, yep, great movies, but I still really like watching them.
Oh, yeah. I actually liked Insurrection. Admittedly, I couldn't watch Nemesis because the idea with some of the stuff they're doing, I was like, I feel like this is jumping a bit of a shark.
Yeah, but I love Tom Hardy in that movie.
Yeah, Tom Hardy's, right, a lot of fun to watch in that.
Yeah,
so.
He's gorgeous. Like, acting ability, I mean, he's a pleasant to look at too. But like, his acting is just so beautiful in that.
Yeah, because right, he's good. Go and especially and go watch him in Peaky Blinders.
All right, Maddie, do you have a favorite series?
I'm boring. The Next Generation. Because, like, I'm old enough that I could have seen at least the original Star Trek in syndication, because I was born in 77. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really first get into Star Trek until I was watching The Next Generation. So I think that will always – and my favorite episode, like, in there. Like, when I saw The Measure of a Man,
oh,
that was, like,
yeah,
that, like sealed it. It's like, yep, I love the show.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, Kelly, actually, I'm very similar to you, where Next Gen is the one that's closest to my heart, because that was the one that literally, that was the first time Dad was like, oh my gosh, sit down and watch this thing. And I was like, okay, I'm bored. And oh my gosh, it's a giant jellyfish in space. I was four, so it took a little to get into it. But admittedly, if my absolute favorite, I love Janeway. So Voyager really – also, I was – a lot of when I watched Voyager, I was in a very odd place. I was at an Assembly of God college. And so that was one of my escapes, was at 2 in the morning. They were showing Voyager, and I was like, please, I need this.
Nope.
Yeah, that's legit. I don't have anything – I mean, I think Voyager was probably the most inconsistent of the series. But I mean, I still love it, and I still love Janeway as a character.
Oh, her character is great fun. The couple of the episodes where basically she takes charge, I think it's Macrocism is where the giant spore things have taken over Voyager. But she had gotten,
the macrovirus.
Yeah, the macrovirus. But she had gotten in trouble with doing negotiations with these aliens because they do hand gestures at the same time. And the putting the hands right on the hips is apparently the equivalent of something really bad in this culture. And it caused a bit of a schism for a while. I just love, because that's her entire approach, is like, fine, you guys are, you know, she was the tough captain. She was the one that says, I'll ask nice first, and then after that, I'm punching. So that's what I liked about Janeway.
And I think that Janeway gets, excuse me, I think Janeway gets a lot of flack that I don't think she really deserves, which is, it's always confusing to me, because I'm like, no, she was a good captain. She kept her, she was in the middle of nowhere with literally nothing to fall back on. She couldn't court-martial somebody, really. So, I mean, holding the crew together like that is pretty awesome.
Well, I've heard people argue that Janeway is somewhat of a monster because of Tuvix. Like, she basically killed Tuvix. And I'm like, God, you know, I can't argue against that. Like, I it's hard for me to say that I would have acted differently, but still, like, that's just that introduces some ambiguity there for me.
Well, but I mean, didn't Tuvix kill both Tuvok and Felix, or Neelix?
Neelix, yes. Yeah. It was a combination of the two.
Yeah, so I mean, it's one of those where there's, like you were saying, there's a lot of ambiguity on there, because it's like, you can bring them back, but you are getting rid of a thing. And
it makes for great discussions. That's what Trek is good for.
And that's what I love about Star Trek is, you know, especially in the original series, I know, and a bit in the Next Gen and DS9 and Voyager, they did bring a lot of these kind of questions to the front. You know, Maddie, you talked about Measure of a Man. Scott, I know you know the episode name, but the one where they had the two people, one had like black on one side.
Let This Be Your Last Battlefield.
Yeah, that one, which tackled the idea of racism.
And so pokes fun at it and talks about it seriously at the same time. Because they're going, well, we're different. And they go, you're black on one side and white on the other. Oh, he's black on this side and I'm black on that side. So there. And just pointing out, it's like, yeah, that totally shows what an incredibly stupid argument that is.
Oh, yes. So what is everyone's favorite episode?
Oh, my God. Do we have 3 hours?
Yeah, that's really tough, because I classify it by series and sometimes even go down to seasons, because
Oh, boy.
You know, keep in mind, some of us are hardcore.
Different categories, too. Because there's my favorite episode of Social Commentary. There's my favorite episode of, like, just sort of, like, awesome sci-fi-ness. And there's my favorite character development episodes.
There's ones you just put in for just plain fun.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
So which one would you say is your favorite for Social Commentary?
Oh, that's so tough. Because there's a good ones. But I look at, you know, the dark, really, as far as dark, is In the Pale Moonlight from Deep Space Nine.
Oh, my God. That's exactly what I was going to say.
And that one talks about, you know, you're talking about really tough ethical and moral decisions here, where they're in the middle of a war. They're kind of not quite winning, but they're not quite losing, and they need to get more help. So how do you bring in a side that doesn't really want to join you, you know, when you've ethically asked them questions? And so you employ the guy who looks upon human ethics as annoyances, and have them do that. So the interaction between Sisko and Garak, that entire episode, is just wonderful stuff, talking about how to be involved in that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, we are going to have to actually go to the break. Sorry about that. We'll pick this up in just a moment with Maddie and Scott here in studio and Callie on Skype. I'm Hertzy Hertz. You're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're tuned in to Atheist Talk, and I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz. I'm in studio talking to today's guests, Maddie Love and Scott Lohman, and on the Skype with Callie Wright. Before we get back, however, I want to remind everyone listening live that immediately following this program, you can listen to American Atheist Viewpoint, an official production of American Atheists. Please note, you can always catch American Atheist Viewpoint by subscribing to the podcast version in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or the podcast player of your choice. As for the here and now, if you'd like to get involved in the conversation with Maddie, Scott, and Nikali, you can call us at 952-946-6205, email us at radio@mnatheist.org, or tweet us at Atheist Talk. Maddie, Scott, Kelly, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey.
All right. So we were talking about our favorite social commentary episode. And we had I believe you said In the Pale Moonlight.
Oh, yeah, from Deep Space Nine.
All right. So then what is your favorite just kind of for fun episode?
Oh, hang on. There's so much more to say about In the Pale Moonlight.
Okay, we'll go back.
Okay, so for context, this is they're deep in the war. Like Scott was saying, they're deep in the war. Things aren't going so well. They're not like on the cusp of defeat, but they can definitely see things turning that way. And they're like, okay, we need a new ally. And we think that our enemy is so the Romulans have signed this non-aggression pact, which means that they're not allies, but they're not enemies. They're just not going to get involved, right? And they're convinced because of the Dominion, who the Dominion is, they're going to betray you at some point. It's just a matter of time.
Which makes sense.
But if there's proof of that, it's buried forever away and we'll never get to it. But like, we have to have them as an ally, right? So they hatched this plan to bring the Romulans into the war by just trying to convince them. And when convincing them doesn't work, it's like, okay, you know what? We're going to lie to them. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Everything that we know about the Federation says that's not what we do, right? We hold to our ideals, honesty, integrity. The first duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth, right? We learned that from Captain Picard. But we have Captain Sisko, who is like, okay, but if we hold to that, we can lose literally everything. Like, we can lose the Federation itself. And so the question is, do you compromise your morality when your very existence is at stake? And of course the answer is yes. But that's a really tough reality to confront, right? And so, I mean, spoiler alert, it's 25 years. If you haven't seen it, I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
But like this, I should have put that at the beginning of
episode. You have a Starfleet officer who ends up complicit in the assassination of a Romulan official to bring the Romulans into the war. And at the end of the episode, basically the impact line is, you know what? I can live with that.
Yep.
And it's just like, wow. Like, it's so like – it's very Star Trek, right? And in that it explores these really tough questions, but it's also not Star Trek because that's very not utopian. You know what I mean?
I think DS9 did a great job of, like, you know, just kind of piercing that utopian veil a little bit, which was kind of good.
It did that wonderfully, and that's what I like about Deep Space Nine. And what's really cool is within the next year or so, I'm not sure the exact date, there'll be a documentary coming out that's being produced by Iris Stephen Bear, who was the writing producer for Deep Space Nine, its entire run. He's the one that helped us sort of refigure the Ferengi into more of a humorous sort of nemesis, as opposed to they originally were going to replace, like, the Klingons and the Romulans as being nasty, and their first appearance was, shall we say, not good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that episode.
Yep. The rest of the episode was really good. That was, you know, during first season Next Gen, and the pilot was good. The first episode out was iffy. The second episode out was extremely iffy. And then we got to The Last Outpost, which was that one. It's like, okay, without the Ferengi, everything else in this episode is really good stuff.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. That little energy whip thing is total. That's total awesome, right?
It was really cool, but that was pretty much the only time they used it. So
yeah, I don't think I ever saw it again.
Except the Marauder Mo action figures and DS9 had them.
Oh, the episode.
When they're at Quark and Rom's mom's house, they have Marauder Mo action figures, and Marauder Mo has a light whip in his hand. Awesome. The action figure does. It's great.
Oh my god, that's adorable.
Yep, they had such fun in the background.
So I'm gonna go just to the tech for a little moment, because Star Trek was, you know, very in its own ways very forward thinking about, you know, what kind of tech and stuff. Sometimes with interesting reasons. But what tech do you desperately want to be real, Callie?
Oh, warp drive.
Yeah.
Well, warp drive or the holodeck / replicators, because they're kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I have to go with replicators. Oh, sorry, Kelly, I interrupted.
No, you're okay. You're okay. I had a deep philosophical discussion about transporters, and I think I am terrified of transporting. So I'm gonna say, like, you know, if that one happens, cool. Probably not gonna be my thing. But yeah, like replicators / holodecks or warp drive.
Yep, warp drive to get us out of here.
Kelly, I'm going right. Kelly, I'm going to start calling you Bones.
Or Barkley.
Oh, gosh, yes.
There we go. Yep.
I like the idea of replicators almost more than warp drive, but I'm also seeing the downside if you can replicate. Like, I'm looking at it from replicating food and replicating stuff for housing and basic needs, and then I'm also thinking, yeah, but replication of weapons, replication of instruments of war, and like...
I mean, there is that, but one of the big things that I love about replicators is that it takes the things that we don't need anymore and breaks it down to its molecular and I think atomic structure and rebuilds it. And so, I mean, think of all the waste that we have and imagine it being all gone.
Oh, I think I still go with replicators. Oh, yeah. It's one of those. Like, I'm only thinking of the good, but there is probably a bad side somewhere, too.
Well, I mean, and there's...
Absolutely.
And there's not great stuff about warp drive, too.
Right. I mean, but the trick is that it then gives us an escape valve, because right now, leaving the solar system is going to take hundreds of years on the lucky side, and we need technology that would be able to work that long, much less still be useful at the end of that time period, in order to even get a couple of people out of our star system.
That is true. So we're gonna go back to, well, the whole thing is Star Trek, but I have this list of, like, kind of question thing. I know, you know, it's like, this is very friendly discussion. So, but Maddie has this awesome question. What was, you know, I think, Callie, you and I think we both grew up with it. Scott, I don't know how old you were when you first watched it.
I was not even 10.
Okay, cool. So great. We all got answers for this. Star Trek as a child, like, what was your first experiences with the show? Callie?
Okay, so the first time I saw Star Trek was in the run-up to the season 4 premiere, which was part 2 of The Best of Both Worlds and of Next Gen.
Yep.
And so there was a Star Trek marathon that was, like, you know, a best of all the episodes leading up to this. And then it played part 1 of Best of Both Worlds and then part 2. And so that was my introduction. Like, I just happened to be at my grandma's house watching TV randomly. She didn't have cable. She just had broadcast TV. So I was just like, oh, there's spaceships and aliens. This is kind of interesting. And I watched it. And so, like, I was immediately hooked as a kid on that. And then not too long after that, I saw the episode The Outcast, which is this episode that has great commentary on gender and sexuality. And as a kid, knowing on whatever level I knew that I was trans, like, that spoke to me, because it's like, oh, this – aside from being sort of a curiosity, this is not a big deal to the people on the Enterprise. And that started to give me the idea, like, oh, the world of Star Trek is a world in which, like, it's not only okay to be different, but in a lot of ways it's cool to be different. And, like, I know I'm different, and so, like, this is a world that I can exist happily in. And so that was the initial draw for me. So it was very much a mix of all of that plus spaceships and aliens.
All right, well, you will have to join back after the break so that we can hear Scott and I's first experiences with Star Trek. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in to American Atheists on AM 950 KTNF. I'm your host, Hertzy Hertz, and we are having what I would classify as a fascinating conversation with Maddie Love, Scott Lohman, and Kelly Wright. Before we continue this conversation, which will be our final segment with Maddie, Scott, and Kelly, there's a bit of housekeeping I need to attend to. Atheist Talk is produced with funding from the Minnesota Atheists and Cucumbers Restaurant in Edina, Minnesota. Please consider visiting our sponsors, and if you do, let them know that you appreciate their support of Atheist Talk. If you'd like to advertise on this program and keep us on the air, please contact us at radio@mnatheist.org. I also want to note the group of dedicated volunteers, including the two in the studio with me, and the generous donations of you, our listeners. You keep Atheist Talk on the air and in podcast form. I also want to note our donors of the week, which is all of you, because you are all awesome. And if you're able to help with a donation, please consider doing so at our Radio Fund page or at our Patreon at www.patreon.com/atheisttalk. Minnesota Atheists is a 501c3 tax-deductible organization, and we couldn't do the show without you, and we deeply appreciate your support. Music for Minnesota Atheists is by composer and member Brent Michael Davis and is used with permission. Please note all opinions are of the guests and hosts only and do not necessarily reflect those of Minnesota Atheists organization. As always, check out the Minnesota Atheists website for podcasts of previous programs. You can browse articles, book reviews, and peruse a calendar of upcoming events. You can also sign up for the American Atheist Weekly email. There's an Atheist Weekly email, and which will give you links to upcoming events. It's a great way to stay connected in the community. If you enjoy this show and all that Minnesota Atheists has to offer, consider becoming a member of Minnesota Atheists while you're on the website. Membership has some great perks. Check out the website for the how and why. With all this relevant and very useful information out of the way, let's get back to Star Trek.
And I want to make one comment to Callie about The Outcast, is that Jonathan Frakes actually was a little annoyed that they cast the other character as female rather than a male.
I know.
He wanted to do that.
One of my favorite things.
To make it an even stronger point on that. That didn't scare him at all doing it that way. He was actually annoyed that they did it that way.
I love that man even more now.
I know. I'm just like, I fully admit I had a crush on Jonathan Frakes when I was a kid because I started Star Trek when I was 4 years old. And it's one of those I was like, it's like I see him now and he's like, oh, that's nice. He's doing stuff. Now it's like, oh, okay, he's cute again.
I read that a long time ago, and I actually had the chance to meet him very briefly at a convention, and I wanted to thank him for that. And I opened my mouth to start talking and instead just started crying and just squeaked out thank you and walked away. So
That's adorable.
Yes.
I was going to say, that sounds about right.
Yeah, and he's also signed to direct a couple more episodes of Discovery. So
nice.
Yeah, they said it was quite fun when he was on directing the episode he did on Discovery, because they're such new kids on the block. They were having fun talking to, as they put it, one of the gods of Star Trek. Anyway, we've got to move on. We got lots to cover in no time.
Yes. All right. So we were talking about first experiences, and Callie, you gave yours. So Scott.
Yeah, mine goes back to watching it on the when the original series was on the air. I cannot remember what was my first episode on that, because it would have been catching it probably before. It would have had to have been second season, and before it got moved to Friday nights at 9, which is the death slot for season 3, because that's when all their target audience was wandering off. But most part, I remember being able to watch it daily on early syndication. And so it was just nice to catch that. Although my fun story with syndication is, while I got to know the series, I could identify the original cuts as opposed to the remastered versions within 10 seconds. I would know which episode it was, and that just annoys my mother no end on that part. But that's how good I am with the original series on that part. So, but there was also a scene I never saw until the episodes were released on videotape, And this is from Shore Leave, and it's the sequence with the rabbit. That was always cut from syndication to add more commercial time during that, and I never saw the rabbit. So I said, they just refer to the damn rabbit because you didn't see any pictures. But then it's like, oh, it's actually there. This is cool to finally see it.
Maddie, do you have an introduction story?
My very first Star Trek experience caused me to not want to watch it for a long time. Aww. Because I was very young, and my parents, I was staying up late, and I was watching the episode, or the second movie, Wrath of Khan. And when they were, it was just the beginning where they're pulling the stuff, I don't remember what they're called now.
The SETI eels.
Yeah, and putting them in their ear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I got in trouble. Because I, like, screamed really loud. Ran it. And then I couldn't, like, step over. That's what I, when we were, like, monsters under the bed as kids, it was those that were under my bed.
Of course. Yep. Oh. Yep, because they're scary monsters
to begin with. So I didn't watch Star Trek again until Next Generation.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, I saw Wrath of Khan on widescreen, so.
That scene still creeps me out. I can't. I, like, close my eyes.
Okay.
So. As I already went through mine. I was 4 years old and got to watch Encounter at Farpoint. So so here's an interesting, because Star Trek, I mean, it's in a sense coming back with J.J. Abrams and the Discovery and such. But J.J. Abrams definitely seemed to take the Star Trek almost, it seems, in a different way. Like there doesn't seem to be the story bite. It wasn't. And then I'm going to bring in Star Trek's worst enemy here, Star Wars, which seems to actually have taken up that bite. How do you guys feel about that? That interesting potential change. I'm not talking Discovery, just the J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, that, you know, is nice, but what, because they did have it in there, but it's so quick, you know, because Captain Pike is talking to the young Kirk and going, well, you know what Starfleet's about. You know, it's humanitarian doing this. And it's like, then they're off back on adventure because they're looking at more. We saw it actually a little more in Star Trek Beyond, because then Simon Pegg did the script on that one, and we got to see a little more of Star Trek's philosophy in that showing up in that. But to me, the thing I appreciate for the Abrams ones is that it reinvigorated interest in the entire franchise. Because when that movie opened, it made $200 million before the end of July when it opened in May. And my wife and I go to bookstores as dates, because, you know, we like books. And so after that one premiered, the half-price stores did not have any of the Star Trek films on the shelf when we'd show up, and they didn't start showing back up in the shelves until August of that summer. So to me, that movie did what I wanted it to do, was to re-show that Star Trek, at that point, at about the ripe old age of 47, was not going to fade into the darkness. And they did it with the original characters and showing that, yes, they can bring that part of the franchise back to life without even starting a new set of characters, like we're seeing in Discovery, and showing that, yes, there's still life in the concept.
Callie?
Yeah, a lot of really hardcore Star Trek fans do not like the J.J. Abrams movies, and I can't even necessarily argue with them and tell them that they're wrong. I did enjoy the J.J. Abrams movies. I don't like them for the same reasons I like other Star Trek. Like, they're very much more just like, hey, we're spaceships and aliens and space battles and future and sci-fi, and like there's a lot less of like what I actually like about Star Trek in there, but that doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just I don't like it for the same reasons. When people say I hate them, I'm like, yeah, I understand why. I just don't hate them.
Yeah, for me, it's like it's great eye candy. I do agree. You know, it did reinvigorate that idea of Star Trek and such. But I just find it interesting that it's like, you know, Star Wars has kind of taken that controversial edge in some ways, or at least that's the one that everyone's, you know, yelling about when it comes to, you know, trying to be progressive.
No, and so we're yelling about, you can't transport to another planet.
Yeah, well there's a lot of things to discuss. That's a whole other three shows if people want to get deep into the weeds on that one.
I know. And we only have like 5 minutes left right now.
Yes.
Kelly, would you be okay with doing some extra content after this?
Sure.
Awesome.
Was that a tease for anybody listening right now that they should become a patron?
That is a tease. You get extra content, and sometimes we geek and sometimes we don't.
Yeah.
So real quick, we should probably hit a little bit on the factor that Star Trek really didn't have a whole lot of religion in it. And Kelly, did that ever affect like your being an atheist at any point?
Ish. So I remember thinking as a kid, there's that episode of Next Gen Evolution where Barkley has that genetic defect that like ends up with everyone de-evolving. And I remember as a kid, when I watched that episode, I was still a Christian and I was thinking like, oh, this is cute, but they're going to feel real silly when they figure out evolution's not real. But there was definitely an element of in Who Watches the Watchers, where Picard calls leaving religion behind an achievement. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. What are they trying to say here? And like that is kind of part of what made me think about getting past all of that. Well, yeah. One thing anyways.
Yeah, and the original series, Roddenberry deliberately did not put a chaplain on the Enterprise. He was asked and he fought that. And so you can see his opinions on religion even showing up as in the original series with Return of the Archons, looking at the Apple, basically using computers as stand-in for God at a lot of point for humans doing that. And going back to Star Trek, the animated series on that episode, How Sharper Than a Serpent's Tooth is basically there's a really powerful being who happens to resemble the god Quetzalcoatl. And he's shown up back in Star Trek's times going, why didn't you guys tell me to come back? And basically at this point, they're saying, sorry, we don't need you. We've managed to grow up all by ourselves.
And there's an annoying reference to religion in Voyager when in the episode Sacred Ground, where Kes gets like knocked out and almost killed by this energy field.
Actually, it's Neelix. Sorry.
Nerd fight. And we love it.
Scott, you got to put your finger in your glasses when you do that.
There we go. Yeah. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
And Janeway has to go on this quest to you know, meet and like convene with the gods to try and plead her case. Yeah, you are, because okay. It's
Kes. there's a different one where Neelix dies and comes back. I'm mixing the two up.
Scott, shame.
Yeah, so Janeway has this moment where she's like, oh my gosh, maybe their gods are real. And she just like gives herself into faith. And then she gets back to Voyager after it's all over with. And everybody's giving her like, oh, here's the scientific explanation for what happens. And Janeway's like, oh yeah, that's super logical, but like it was probably just their gods. And I was like, no, like that's not who you are. Like, and I get what they were trying to do, but.
That's one of the points with DS9 that always was a little odd for me, is like, because in the first episode of DS9, they kind of explain what the prophets are, and they come back and everyone on Bajor is kind of like, oh no, we still believe they're gods. I'm looking going, but you have the thing. How does this
Well, and with the Q continuum, like what does any god that's in any religion do that Q can't do, or that the continuum can't do?
I would say have empathy, but, you know, the Christian God really doesn't have that either.
Which then gets to one of my favorite Voyager episodes, which is Death Witch, which is what goes on when an immortal creature wants to die.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great discussion about the afterlife, where they use a gas station on a road in the desert, and they talk about the afterlife. And it's like, oh, that's such a wonderful metaphor on that, because they talk about, well, you can go down to that end of the road and to that end of the road, or you can even be the Scarecrow, which they had one of those on there. So, you know, talking about that it just goes on forever and it's all boring, and unfortunately now we're out of time.
Oh, well, we got 45 seconds. Well, thank you, Scott, Callie, and Maddie for joining us. We will definitely have an extended episode for anyone who's on Patreon. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Only $1 an episode.
Oh, yes. But I am proud to be on the air with Minnesota Atheists, and I hope that you enjoyed the show. The show depends on your generous support of members, our sponsors, and our donors, and our volunteers. Please consider supporting the show through the donation link. And this has been Atheist Talk on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hello. Hello and welcome to the American Atheist Viewpoint. I'm Nick Fish, National Program Director for American Atheists, and thank you as always for joining us. This week we're back from our national convention in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and had a really fantastic convention with more than 850 people, including more than 300 people from Oklahoma. This has been one of our larger conventions lately, and is certainly one that was that exceeded our expectations for Oklahoma City. The venue that we were holding the convention at only held about 600 people, and so we actually had to have an overflow room for all the folks who registered a little bit later. We had a great time with keynote speaker Hugh Laurie, just some really fantastic conversation with him and Dave Silverman. We had really fantastic speakers ranging from the Reverend Barry Lynn, former executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, to Brooke Binkowski, the managing editor of Snopes.com, Gavin Grimm, a civil rights activist, Mary Johnson, a former nun with the with Mother Teresa's order. Just some really fantastic speakers with some really compelling stories about a wide range of topics. On top of that, it wasn't just the speakers. I don't think anyone attends American Atheists National Convention solely for the speakers. Certainly, we want to have new and interesting folks up on stage to present topics that have never been heard before, to present new faces, and to fully represent our community. But one of the main reasons that people come to our events is for the community. And that's what I want to talk about this week. One of the things that we really talk about a lot here at American Atheists is how do we provide a support network? How do we help folks who are leaving religion to find the things that they've left behind and the things that kept them in the pews for as long as it did? That's one of the main struggles, is how do you organize people who are suspicious of organized religion? How do you unite people around a common thing other than not believing in God? That's the struggle. That's the question that we have to reconcile, and how the thing that we have to do if we're going to accomplish many of the things that we're setting out to do, especially in the arena of politics and creating an atheist voting bloc, and in normalizing atheism. This is a really key component to what we want to do, is building communities that people want to be a part of. And I think we were very successful with that with our national convention, and creating a group, creating an environment, creating an atmosphere that people felt safe in, and that they felt was about more than just, you know, getting around and talking about not believing in God, which is the sort of stereotype or the caricature that folks in the media like to have about our events, where they'll literally ask me, what do you guys do? Just get around and agree that there is no God? And the answer to that question is no. We talk about much more, and we do much more. So in addition to talking about how we're going to build these communities and giving folks really tangible tools to do that, we put our money where our mouth is. American Atheists donated $7,500 to a food bank in order to package 30,000 meals for less fortunate folks in Oklahoma City. This was done in partnership with a group called the Outreach Project, and we worked for about 2 hours packaging those 30,000 meals. And it was a really inspirational thing for us to do, and something that the folks who stuck around on Sunday evening really had a great time doing, because it, you know, it had nothing to do with atheism. It had everything to do with making our communities better. And that's the common thread that ties all of our groups and all of us together, is we know that we're the ones that have to make the change. We're the ones who we have to rely on if we want to improve the quality of life in our communities. And so it's something that we really want to stress. And it's something that with our shift toward local activism and with our emphasis on working in small communities to normalize atheism and to build robust affiliates and robust groups to provide community for folks who are leaving religion, it's really a key component in the quest to create these sorts of groups. We're talking a lot about what we're calling our ACEs program, which is four primary areas of focus. that we think every group should at least touch on, because every group that we have that is successful, that that really has a vibrant and thriving community, focuses on these three things. A is for activism, meaning being involved in politics, being involved in the issues of the day in your local community, in your city, in your state, getting active. Those things don't have to be just atheist issues. Anything that people in your group care about, that's an atheist issue. That's an issue that your atheist group should feel free to weigh in on. We're not going to tell you that you have to do X, Y, or Z. We're just going to give you the tools to accomplish those things and to get involved as atheists. Because when you do that, you demonstrate to potential allies for when there are fights about church-state separation issues, you demonstrate that you show up to help them and that you're on their side and that you're willing to help. So that's activism. That's the first thing. The second is community service. This is what I'm talking about with packing meals for folks who are less fortunate, organizing blood drives, doing things in your community to actively improve them, and showing that it's not just churches that have food pantries and not just churches that donate to the hungry or help the homeless. You know, these are things that you don't need religion to do and are a great way to build a community. That's something that many people really like that their church did and miss that when they leave a church. And so demonstrating that we're part of the community and that we're involved in actively making it better is a really powerful statement to make, even if it has nothing to do with atheism. It has everything to do with being a humanist and with improving the lives of our fellows. That's a key component of normalizing atheism. The third piece of the puzzle is education. This is a way of not just improving our community, but improving ourselves. Thinking critically about religion, thinking critically about the things we believe, and just learning more about what it is that we want to focus on and more about the world around us. This is something that churches do not such a great job of, because the education typically is through that lens of propping up the religion. But you know, we want folks to be educated about the world around them. And the last component, and this is really key, is social. We want our groups to be social. We want them to provide a support network. We want them to have fun. This is a really important part of what our national convention is about. It's about having a great time with your fellow atheists. Just for many of the folks who are attending our convention, this is literally the first time that they've ever been in a room with fellow atheists. And the fun and the social side of that is a really key component of making a successful event and making a successful group. These are the resources that we're putting out there for our affiliates. More information about these programs will be available on our website, as well as just how-to guides, because we know that this stuff is not easy. It's not obvious. And people have questions. Nobody trains you how to run an atheist group. So we want to give the folks who are on the ground doing activism, on the ground doing community service, doing education, and creating social circles for atheists, we want them to have the resources they need to be successful. And so that's the focus for us for the next year, and it's something that we really put a priority on for our national convention. That's all the time I have for this week. Thank you, as always, for joining us. For more information about our work, please visit www.atheists.org. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next time.